Tonight we are going to be dealing with Chapter 11, Private Remedies and Public Enforcement. I'm not going to read everything in here, but I'm going to touch on some things here to help you get more well-rounded information on this. Keep in mind, these books, these NCLC books, are the books that are used to train consumer lawyers, the ones that go to bat for us, the ones that help us out by defending against these other suits, and they're also the ones that will file suits on our behalf for violations. Only, as we talk about all the time, we learn to do it ourselves. Why pay somebody else? Why have somebody else? This is something we need to learn to do ourselves. So that's what we're doing. All right. I'm going to read the introduction here because I want you to get an idea of where we're going with this. Keep in mind that this is written, and some of what I will say is kind of related to having an attorney reading this. So we're going to turn you into an attorney-type student for a while here. Once the theory of the case and the nature of the claims have been decided upon, the practicalities of litigation must be considered. I'm going to do the best I can with my eyes here because they're getting a little funky on me here tonight again. This chapter covers everything from selection of parties and court to private remedies following a successful court challenge to consumer reporting practices. It is worth noting, however, that consumers also have non-litigation approaches to dealing with credit reporting problems, approaches provided by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. An example, disputing an inaccurate report or discovering the contents of the consumer's file. Avenues provided by other laws, example, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act and Fair Credit Billing Act, dispute rights. Or by no particular law, example, explaining a bad credit rating to a potential creditor. These non-litigation consumer options are described throughout the manual. The chapter focuses specifically on litigation and its remedies, and obviously that's where we're going, that's why we're going to focus on this, with a brief discussion of public enforcement as well. An FCRA case should be undertaken from the beginning with an eye to establishing damages and obtaining an award, well, of attorney's fees, but we're not interested in that. We're doing this ourselves. The scope of damages under the Act is broad and may include actual, statutory, and punitive damages. The damages suffered by an individual consumer from an inaccurate consumer report or from other FCRA violations may not always be apparent. Building a case for damages begins with an attorney's initial contact with the consumer. Similarly, a successful claim for attorney's fees, okay, we don't need to read that. In other words, you got to know what you're doing. You have to get your facts together before you start into this process. You have to understand what you have on hand as far as your credit reports. You have to have an understanding of the law so that you can understand where the violations are. Maximizing damage awards and recovering the full amount of attorney's fees to which one is entitled serves several purposes. In addition to fully recompensing injury and the expense of litigation, adequate awards to plaintiffs create incentives for defendants to police themselves and avoid further FCRA violations. Now, see, this is what we talk about all the time. If we start taking money out of their pockets, they're going to start being a lot more careful on what they're doing so that they can minimize that. The more they expose themselves, the more it's going to cost them. That's why it's important for us to have a lot of people doing this. There's strength in numbers, including exactly what we're doing here. The large volume of bad reporting and unresolved consumer complaints is evidence of the need for greater enforcement of the FCRA. Since little public enforcement occurs, private enforcement is the primary method of assuring compliance and policing the industry. Now, that's real important. They are depending on us to be doing this. We are finally stepping up and doing what we should have been doing all along, but we have to be educated in order to do it. Substantial damage awards should bring about greater compliance and serve users and consumers well. Likewise, full and adequate attorney fee awards will promote private attorney involvement in FCRA cases. We, when we bring a case, are acting as private attorney generals. And that was the intent of Congress when they wrote this law. Please understand that. When you bring an action for FCRA violations, you are in fact acting as a private attorney general. All right, selecting the parties. First of all, you got plaintiffs. The FCRA provides that any person who fails to comply with any FCRA requirement with respect to any consumer is liable to that consumer. A consumer is broadly defined as any individual. Consequently, any individual can bring an FCRA action where an FCRA requirement has been violated with respect to that individual. Thus, a consumer may have standing to sue even where the reported issue is on the consumer's spouse, not on the consumer, and contains no information about the consumer, provided that the information in the file adversely affects the consumer. A wife, for example, may sue where information in the husband's report impaired the wife's ability to obtain financing on jointly owned property. All right, I'm going to give you a couple case citations here. Roybal, spelled R-O-Y-B-A-L, versus Equifax. And that is a Eastern District of California case from October of 2008. And there's a little note in here. Finding wife had standing based on joint mortgage account listed on husband's credit report because it bears on her creditworthiness. All right. Another case is Barron, B-A-R-R-O-N, versus TransUnion Corp. And that is from the Middle District of Alabama for 2000. And a note on that is wife had standing to sue credit reporting agency with respect to wife and husband's joint application for consumer loan that was denied based on alleged inaccurate information contained in husband's consumer report, inasmuch as husband's consumer report had negative bearing on wife's creditworthiness. So I'm trying to make a point here for you. There is a connection between one spouse to another. All right. On the other hand, a merely derivative claim where the information does not refer or relate to the plaintiff at all will likely be dismissed. In other words, there has to be a connection how it affects you. And I will give you a couple of case citations on that. Kane, spelled C-A-I-N, versus TransUnion, LLC. That's a Western District of Washington from February of 06. And the note there is wife lacks standing to recover separate damages even if CRA's allegedly willful failure to correct a trade line in husband's credit report injured marital community by impairing couple's ability to obtain loan to purchase a home. All right. Because the FCRA is remedial in nature, the estate of a decedent may sue. Okay, if you've got a situation where somebody has passed away and there's an issue where the state might want to take an action, they can do so. And I'll give you a case citation there. Saturno, spelled S-A, T-U-R-N-O versus, boy, Dovenmuehle funding. Okay, I'm going to spell that one. D-O-V-E-N-M-U-E-H-L-E Funding, Inc. And that is a Connecticut Superior Court case from February of 2001. And one other one is White versus Imperial Adjustment Corporation. And that is an Eastern District of Louisiana case from February of 2005. All right. Go back and read that last sentence again. Because the FCRA is remedial in nature, the estate of a decedent may sue. However, a claim may not be brought for improperly accessing the consumer's report when the consumer predeceased the allegedly impermissible access. In other words, if the person died before the credit pull occurred, the person isn't here to be harmed by it, and you can't do anything. Suit by an association of individuals is also problematic. A consumer may sue under the FCRA for inaccurate information relating to a business debt so long as it appears in a consumer report. And a couple case citations on this is Tilley, T-I-L-L-E-Y, versus Global Payments, Inc. And that's District of Kansas from 2009. And another one is Hunt versus Experian Information Solutions. And that is a District of Nebraska case from 2006. Nor is there any requirement that the plaintiff have clean hands or that the action be in the public interest. For example, a consumer can bring an FCRA claim against a user even if the consumer had submitted a fraudulent insurance claim to the user. That's interesting. Got a couple case citations here for you. St. Paul Guardian Insurance Company versus Johnson. And that is a Fifth Circuit case from 1989. And another case is Clapper, spelled K-L-A-P-P-E-R, versus Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O. And that is New York State Superior Court, 1992. All right, now I am not going to touch on class action stuff here. There's a lot of information on that, but I'm not going to cover that for the simple reason that an incredibly small number of people would even consider any kind of a class action suit, and I don't know of anybody that would attempt to do something like that on their own. And if you were going to do a class action for some reason, I think it'd be in your best interest to have an attorney involved in it anyway. All right, let's go and talk about defendants here. In general, any person who fails to comply with any requirement with respect to a consumer may be liable under the FCRA. All right. Now, consumer reporting agencies, users of consumer reports, and those who furnish information to CRAs are liable for violations. And for those of you out there, CRA is a credit reporting agency, for anybody that doesn't understand what I'm saying there. They are liable for violations. Okay, question of contribution between the defendants for violations of the CRA is discussed further here. Okay, consumer reporting agency is a defined term, but user and furnisher of information are not. Nevertheless, the FCRA sets out several requirements for those who use consumer reports, as well as for those who furnish information to CRAs. While there should generally be little question whether an entity is covered as a user or furnisher of information, issues sometimes arise. In Reynolds versus Hartford Financial Services Group, for example, the Ninth Circuit held that several affiliated insurers could be held liable as users for failing to provide adverse action notices, even though only one of them issued a policy to the insured. Whether an employer of a user may also be a user subject to suit will depend upon whether the employee user is acting within the scope of employment. That's kind of interesting, and I've got a case citation here for you. That is Graves versus Tubb, T-U-B-B. And that is out of the Northern District of Mississippi, 2003. In suing a CRA, consider any corporation in the chain of corporate ownership and all the CRAs in the chain of distribution. Be sure to identify the correct entity. For example, Equifax, Inc. is merely a holding company, not a CRA. Okay, and there's a case citation here for that. It's Ransom, R-A-N-S-O-M, versus Equifax, Inc., and that is the Southern District of Florida of 2010. A consumer may sue both the national repository of credit information and the local or regional entity which provided the consumer report based on information gleaned from the national repository. All right, and a case citation on that is Verdin, V-E-R-D-I-N, versus Equifax Services, Inc. And that is Eastern District of Louisiana, May of 92. Also consider not only the corporate entities involved in violating the act, but also individuals who actually participated in the violation, for instance, by obtaining a report for impermissible purposes. Okay, there's case citations here. Got a couple of them for you. Mone, spelled M-O-N-E, versus Dranow, spelled D-R-A-N-O-W. And that case is out of the Ninth Circuit in 1991. Another one is Yohay, spelled Y-O-H-A-Y, versus City of Alexandria Employees Credit Union. and that is the Fourth Circuit, 1987. Likewise, the employer of a rogue employee who pulls another's credit report for personal reasons may be held liable for an impermissible pull on the basis of both an agency theory and respondeat superior. And you've heard me use that term, respondeat superior, if the employee was acting within the scope of her employment. Okay, a couple case citations here. Mahan, spelled M-A-H-J-A-N, versus Kumar, spelled K-U-M-A-R. And that is from the Eastern District of California, May of 2008. And something else you should look at, another case here, Ellis, E-L-L-I-S, versus Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency. That's a long one. Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, Central District of California, September of 2008. And the note under this is denying summary judgment to KeyBank as it may have controlled how the agency conducted the responsibilities KeyBank delegated to it, and listing cases. But you need to read these cases if you've got any idea of wanting to utilize this, then be sure you read these cases. Got somebody that needed to be muted on the board here, unfortunately. Okay, remember, however, that the Act permits information to be shared freely among affiliates outside the strictures of the law, largely without regard for FCRA privacy protections and requirements for accuracy. Where a creditor is found to have furnished inaccurate information to one CRA, it probably has furnished the same inaccurate information to other CRAs as well. Logic would tell you that. Information obsolete at one CRA will be obsolete at another CRA as well. Where an individual has no permissible purpose to obtain reports from one CRA, it will have no permissible purpose to obtain a report from another CRA. There is thus a strong potential that where one CRA has violated the FCRA, another has too, in the same way. It thus may make sense to bring different but similar actions against various CRAs. Well, yeah, I'm going to be suing the CRAs before long. An additional reason to sue more than one CRA is that losing a case against a CRA may bar a separate case raising the same issue against a different CRA. But the reverse is not true. A pro se consumer who litigated the reasonableness of one CRA's procedures has been held to be collateral estopped from relitigating the reasonableness of the same procedures against a different CRA. And I'm going to give you a case citation on that. Houston versus TransUnion Credit Info Company. And that is from the Southern District of New York, September of 1990. In considering which defendants to include in the action, attention should also be paid to whether there is a colorable claim of personal jurisdiction over the particular defendant. Okay, that subject is discussed in another section. All right, what about government defendants and sovereign immunity? You know, I don't think that we're really going to get into that. I think there's so few people that are dealing with that. If somebody had a situation with the government entities, I would, and you wanted to study this information, I would very strongly suggest you find your local law library and get into the Fair Credit Reporting Act and CLC books and look that information up so that you could study it. I just don't think that's something that a great number of our people would have an interest in here. I think those cases are going to be very few and far between, to be honest. All right. Case selection. There is no magic formula for winning an FCRA case. The odds of prevailing are high if the facts strongly point to a clear injustice, where common sense indicates that there has been a violation and the result emerges without any apparent weighing or balancing test. Examples include where a file is on the wrong consumer because the CRA ignored the proper Social Security number, or where a CRA is specifically apprised of an error and asked to correct it, but continues to furnish incorrect reports or reinserts the same erroneous information after deleting it. A case is more attractive if the consumer suffered direct injury from the violation, such as being turned down for credit. Nevertheless, compelling evidence of mental anguish, embarrassment, humiliation, and or loss of reputation will enhance damages from what may be difficult to quantify economic losses. A negligent case cannot succeed and therefore should not be brought in the absence of some evidence of actual damages. That's very important. Statutory damages are available in the alternative for willful violations, however, as well as punitive damages in appropriate circumstances. Now, I'm going to read that again. Statutory damages are available in the alternative for willful violations, however, as well as punitive damages in appropriate circumstances. It also helps the case to emphasize CRA delays, runarounds, and obfuscations. Detail the amount of time the consumer spent trying to straighten out the record. And I want to comment on that very briefly. When you are working on these things, try and keep somewhat of a log of some sort or just some kind of notes as to roughly how much time you have spent, whether you're going through the notice of intent to sue or the notice of pending lawsuit, how long it takes you to do these letters, how long does it take you to write the lawsuit, how long did it take you to do the research to learn this, how much time have you spent educating yourself so that you can take this action. All of this stuff should be added up. It's not going to hurt you one bit. It may come in handy. You may find that you don't need it, but it's going to be hard for you to just go and grasp something out of the air if you haven't been doing it kind of on an ongoing basis. Well, you know, I spent an hour and a half here. I spent 45 minutes there. Wow, I had no idea I had 22 hours in this already. You know, once you get to doing this, it doesn't take that much time. But when you're first starting, it does take much more time, without a doubt. All right, it also... Okay, detail the amount of time the consumer spent trying to straighten out the record. Often CRAs can take up to 6 months to handle a complaint, and this may not appear reasonable to judges or juries. I think if I was sitting on a jury, I wouldn't find that very reasonable either. In recent years, two possible hurdles to bringing claims against CRAs and furnishers have arisen. One is that the consumer may need to prove that a disputed item was in fact inaccurate. And bringing cases challenging CRA procedures for maximum possible accuracy, and increasingly in cases for failure to conduct a reasonable investigation, the information at issue must actually be inaccurate for liability to incur. In other words, you can't just allege something's inaccurate. It has to be. All right, the more an inaccuracy can be documented and objectively shown, the stronger the case. Common sense. The other is that at least in some jurisdictions, the heightened pleading standards of Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, and we hear that all the time, and Ashcroft versus Iqbal, that's the other one where they're using the tightened pleading standards, so to speak, may be a barrier to discovery needed to show that the CRA conveyed the dispute to the furnisher. The effect of this new pleading standard is discussed in greater depth in another part of the book here. Actually, those haven't made that much of a difference if you have a good pleading that you're writing. Those were kind of they were to keep some of the ridiculous suits out, basically, is what it boils down to. And there's a lot of people that don't read them. I would suggest everybody go and read Bell Atlantic versus Twombly and Ashcroft versus Iqbal, spelled I-Q-B-A-L. As in any area of litigation, filing a frivolous case can subject a consumer and her attorney to monetary sanctions for violation of Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which requires an attorney who multiplies the proceedings in any case unreasonably and vexatiously to pay fees reasonably incurred because of such conduct. In other words, you need to write a good complaint, and there needs to definitely be a violation there. Otherwise, if you get ridiculous and make some kind of claims, and this goes for anything, this goes for FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, if you don't do your homework and know what you're doing, you possibly can get yourself in that position. But somebody has to be pretty foolish to get yourself there. I know of people that have done it. One individual in particular. I'm not going to name any names, but people can shoot themselves in the foot if they get really stupid and trying to do this. Further, in FCRA litigation, 18 U.S.C. 1681N(c) entitles a prevailing defendant to an award of reasonable attorney's fees from a plaintiff who proceeded under the FCRA in bad faith or for the purposes of harassment. We don't want to be doing this for harassment. You know, and I'm going to give you a case citation on that. Maylee, spelled M-A-Y-L-E, versus Equifax. Information Systems, LLC. And that comes out of the Northern District of Illinois in March of 2005. Okay, and just a comment that's here with that. Monetary sanctions ordered for frivolous claim on disputed debt involving funds deposited into plaintiff's account. Subsequent proceedings are reported at such and such. Okay. For this reason, it is also prudent to resolve questionable claims by settlement and mutual release in order to prevent a subsequent motion for fees by defense counsel. In other words, if you've got a situation where somebody gets real aggressive on this stuff, that's just that much more of an incentive for you to work out a settlement with them and get the thing behind you, rather than getting yourselves stuck in a corner and you being hard-headed and potentially getting yourself in that situation. And an individual that did get sanctioned that I'm aware of was headed that direction, and more than one person, myself included, warned the individual not to do that. Repeatedly warned the individual that he had to take a different tact and should take a tact towards settlement, and the individual refused. And the court actually turned around and sanctioned him several thousand dollars. And very honestly, the individual only had himself to blame. Okay, selecting a court. The FCRA claims may be brought in federal or state court. The FCRA provides that actions may be brought in federal courts without regard to the amount in controversy or in any other court of competent jurisdiction. All right, and that's under 15 U.S.C. 1681P, for those that wanted to look at that. Bringing an action in state court does not alter substantive rights. And there's actually a case citation there. Ackerley, spelled A-C-K-E-R-L-E-Y, versus Credit Bureau of Sheridan, spelled S-H-E-R-I-D-A-N, Inc., and that's the District of Wyoming from 1974. And there's actually another one here. There is Emerson, E-M-E-R-S-O-N, versus J. F. Shea Company, spelled S-H-E-A Company. And that's California Appeals Court, California Reporter, 1978. California Reporter 170, 1978. All right. If state court is a preferred forum, one advantage of including an FCRA claim is that it authorizes an award of punitive damages under certain circumstances, while state claims may not. All right. Now, I want to go back something. All right. If state court is a preferred forum, one advantage, this is a wrong statement. If state court is a preferred forum, one advantage of including an FCRA claim is that it authorizes an award of punitive damages under certain circumstances, while state claims may not. I think they meant to say federal court. However, if an FCRA claim is included in the state court action, the defendant has the option of removing the case to federal court. You want to be aware of that. If an FCRA claim is included in the state court action, the defendant has the option of removing the case to federal court. And now take note, too, that certain fair credit reporting claims may be available under a state statute, but not the FCRA. For example, although there is no private right of action to enforce the requirements of 15 U.S.C. 1681 S2A, such a right is available under the analogous California statute, and this claim is not preempted by the FCRA. Now, that's specific to the California people. In general, bankruptcy courts do not have subject matter jurisdiction of a debtor's claims against a CRA. Now, that's kind of interesting there, and I'm going to give you a case citation. I'll actually give you two of them for this. CASIM, spelled K-A-S-I-M, versus Equifax Information Services, LLC, and that comes from the District of Oregon, and that's from November of 2008, Another case is Duke versus TransUnion, District of Oregon, and that is from September of 2008. All right. On the other hand, a federal district court in which an FCRA claim for inaccurate reporting of a discharged debt is pending may be able to hear a related claim for violation of the discharge injunction. Indeed, the failure to assert this claim in the pending district court proceeding may bar its later assertion in the bankruptcy court. In other words, you'd have to file your claim in the district court as opposed to the bankruptcy court. Bringing related state law claims in federal court. It often makes sense to join various related common law tort or statutory claims in an FCRA claim in federal court. Okay, like most other federal statutes, the FCRA contains no provision on joining state law claims, so practitioners must turn to the federal statute on supplemental jurisdiction. And actually, there is a case citation here, Pletz, P-L-E-T-Z, versus MBNA America. And that was from the Southern District of Illinois in February of 06. The test is whether the claim for which jurisdiction is sought is part of the same case or controversy as the FCRA claim, under Article 3 of the United States Constitution. All right, this test turns on whether there is a common nucleus of operative facts between the federal and state law claims. If this test is met, in other words, if there's common facts between the state and federal claims, then you can do it. If this test is met, the district court nevertheless has discretion to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claim if the claim raises a novel or complex issue of state law. The federal court doesn't want to get into real novel and complex state issues. The claim, and number two, the claim substantially predominates over the claim or claims over which the district court has original jurisdiction. In other words, they don't want something where the other, the state claim is really a bigger deal than the federal claim that you, any federal claims you may have. Number three, the district court has dismissed all claims over which it has original jurisdiction, which would mean then all the federal court would be dealing strictly with a state issue. That's not going to work either. Number four, in exceptional circumstances, there are other compelling reasons for declining jurisdiction. Now, here again, that's where the federal court may choose to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction. This statutory test is somewhat more conducive to a court accepting supplemental jurisdiction than the pendant jurisdiction test, which prevailed prior to the statute's enactment in 1990. So caution should be exercised in relying on proper case on prior case law. All right. However, it is worth bearing in mind that a connection between the state and federal claims is not necessarily sufficient. For example, state law claims arising from a yo-yo sale have been held not to share a common nucleus of operative facts with an FCRA impermissible pull claim, even though the pull was with respect to the earlier sale. Well, that's kind of interesting. I'm going to read that again. For example, state law claims arising from a yo-yo sale have been held not to share a common nucleus of operative fact with an FCRA impermissible pull claim, even though the pull was with respect to the earlier sale. And there is actually a case citation there that you can go and read and kind of help understand that. Boy, the first name here is odd. Trick, spelled T-R-E-G-P, as in Paul, versus Germain, G-E-R-M-A-I-N, Ford, of Columbus. And that's from the Southern District of Ohio, September of 2009. The court further held, even if it had discretion to consider the state law claims, it would not have exercised it because the state claims predominate over the federal one. Well, you know, if they're going to predominate, then they don't want to have anything to do with it, which is understandable. Defendant furnishers may file a state law-based counterclaim against the consumer to collect the underlying debt. And this subject is discussed in another area of the book. Okay, personal jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction must exist to proceed against a defendant. If the suit is brought in state court, state jurisdictional rules will, of course, apply. Even if a case is brought in federal court, whether personal jurisdiction exists may be a matter determined under state law. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure limit federal court's authority to serve non-resident defendants to those who can be served under the forum state's law. And that's actually under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Procedure 4, Parens E, if you wanted to look at that and read that. When personal jurisdiction is raised as an issue, courts will determine whether the forum state's long-arm statute provides a basis for jurisdiction. Now, are you starting to get the idea here that it's a lot simpler to bring these FCRA cases that we deal with in federal court and not be messing around with the state courts? It is much simpler. We don't have the issues. If a basis for jurisdiction exists, it is possible a second question will arise. That is whether the defendant has had sufficient minimum contacts with the forum state to satisfy questions of the 14th Amendment due process rights. Often state law permits personal jurisdiction to the maximum extent allowed by due process, i.e., provided there are minimum contacts. So as you can see, there are multiple issues that you get into and multiple potential problems that you can have if you go about doing litigation under the FCRA in a state court. In suits against CRAs, the question of personal jurisdiction will rarely arise. Most CRAs are certainly the nationwide CRAs, and certainly the nationwide CRAs will be doing business in every state. However, when a defendant is out of state and a user of a consumer report or a furnisher of information to a CRA, or has obtained a report improperly, questions of personal jurisdiction can sometimes arise. Had to get a bit of a drink there. In such cases, the law of the state in which the court is located must be considered. The Supreme Court has held that where a defendant who purposefully has directed his activities at forum residence seeks to defeat jurisdiction, he must present a compelling case that the presence of some other considerations would render jurisdiction unreasonable. It is also held that personal jurisdiction is available in defamation cases where the victim is harmed, even if publication originates elsewhere. All right, and we've got a case citation on that, actually two of them. Calder, spelled C-A-L-D-E-R, versus Jones. And let's see, that is, I think that's Louisiana Eastern District from 1984. All right, Brown, another one is Brown versus Flowers Industries. That is a Fifth Circuit case from 1982. All right, personal jurisdiction has thus frequently been found proper in the state where the subject of the consumer report resides or allegedly suffered the harm. That's where your personal jurisdiction is going to come from. All right, and there's various case citations there. I'll give you two of them. Scott versus Real Estate Finance Group. And that is Second Circuit from 1999. And Han, spelled H-A-H-N, versus Star Bank. And that is the Sixth Circuit from 1999. Personal jurisdiction has thus frequently been found proper in a state where the subject of the consumer report resides or allegedly suffered harm. For example, personal jurisdiction was found where the defendant knew or should have known that the disputed consumer report would have adverse effects in the plaintiff's forum and voluntarily generated contacts in the forum to collect the disputed debt. Similarly, personal jurisdiction was held proper even if the defendant did not intend to target a debtor in another state because defendant was informed of the harm to plaintiff's credit record in his home state where the jurisdiction was sought. All right. Likewise, a complaint sufficiently alleged jurisdiction by asserting that the defendant, an investigative services company, caused tortious injury by an act or omission in this commonwealth, this is quote unquote, when it obtained her consumer credit report without a permissible purpose because the defendant knew that the effects of his actions were going to be felt within Massachusetts. Although the defendant's place of business was in New York and he made the inquiry from a computer in New York to a CRA located in New York, the court ruled that it was reasonable to conclude that the defendant knew his actions would have specific effect in Massachusetts because he had inputted the plaintiff's Massachusetts address in order to obtain the report. Furthermore, the knowledge fulfilled the Constitution's requirement that the defendant, quote, reasonably anticipate being hailed into court, unquote, in Massachusetts. Yeah, be sued in Massachusetts. And there's a case citation on that. Worldwide Volkswagen Corporation versus Woodson, spelled W-O-O-D-S-O-N. And that's a Supreme Court case, 444 U.S. 286, 297, 100. S period, CT period, 559, comma, 62, capital L period, capital E small d period, 2D, the D is small d, 490 from 1980. However, where the tortious conduct is not expressly aimed at the forum state, jurisdiction may be lacking. Even where some conduct is aimed at the forum state, it may be insufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. Thus, a New York investigator who obtained a consumer report on a Maryland resident and hired a Maryland company to conduct a criminal check has been held not subject to personal jurisdiction in Maryland. Defendant's only contacts with Maryland were its occasional placement of telephonic orders for and consequent receipt of investigation services from Maryland, which it then furnished to clients in other states. And I will give you case citation there, which is Stover, S-T-O-V-E-R, versus O'Connell, O apostrophe C-O-N-N-E-L-L, Associates, Inc. And that is a Fourth Circuit decision from 96. Personal jurisdiction over employees of a CRA may also be more difficult to obtain. A state's long-arm statute may not reach individuals whose only connection with the local jurisdiction is activity within the scope of their employment with the CRA.